Hi everyone, and welcome back to the 26th video for the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we're going to complete the historical books by looking at the book of Esther. Now, Esther is a remarkable story and a beautiful story, and there's a lot more going on than meets the eye at first. But let's start with some background issues. First, the author of Esther is anonymous. We have no idea and no good guesses who the author might be. But he's a brilliant author, masterful storyteller. Now, of course, all the biblical authors are brilliant, but this is especially true of the author of Esther, who's a master of understatement and irony. Now, the location of the story is the Persian Empire. The Persians took over from the Babylonians. And the story of Esther all takes place in the capital city of Susa, but it affects the entire Persian Empire, including the Promised Land. Now, the date of the book of Esther is between the first and second return to the Promised Land recorded in the book of Ezra. But we'll look at the exact dates and the timeline in just a bit. Now, Esther is much more than a love story. It explains the reasons behind the Jewish feast of Purim, but there's much more than just that. It brilliantly describes God's faithfulness to his people and to his promises. Now, speaking of God, the book of Esther doesn't. This book is notorious in the Bible because there is no mention of God in the entire book. And some ancient rabbis even questioned whether it should be in the Bible for this reason. Yes, God is not explicitly mentioned in the book, but I believe God is all over this book. We need to look behind the scenes. We need to look with eyes of faith. We must pay attention to the way that the author tells the story, and we will see God in this book. Now let's look at the organization of the book of Esther. The organization is very simple, using a standard storytelling technique. First, it narrates the problem. A Persian official conspires to kill all the Jews, and he has the power to do so. By the way, Hitler was not the first person to attempt to exterminate the Jews, not even close. Now, if all of the Jews die in the book of Esther, that means that God's promises to Abraham and to David will fail. Now, do you see the problem? But of course, then the story goes on and tells of God's providential solution. God does work it out through what was unforeseen circumstances and through his people's faithfulness in the circumstances which they are given. Now, we'll go through the plot in more detail in just a bit. But first, let's look at the content with some key verses. The first key verse is Esther chapter 4, verses 12 through 16, which says, "When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: 'Do not think that because you are in the king's house that you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to this royal position for such a time as this?' Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai: 'Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. And when this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish.'" Now, this passage is important for a few reasons. First, Mordecai expresses confidence that deliverance for the Jews would happen one way or the other. But he also encourages Esther that she might have been providentially placed in her role for such a strategic time and situation as this. And therefore, she should be faithful to do what is right in her moment of opportunity. And Esther requests a fast, but does not mention prayer with that. And this omission is, I think, significant, and it's an ironic understatement. And Esther does commit to do what is right, even at tremendous risk to herself. The next key verse is chapter 6, verses 1 through 10. It says, that night, the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. The king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he had erected for him. So the king's attendants answered, Haman is standing in the court. Bring him in, the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man that the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, Who is there that the king would rather honor than me? So he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe that the king has worn and a horse that the king has ridden, one with the royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended. Now, this passage represents the beginning of the downfall, the turnaround of the story, when the bad guy starts to lose. And notice how this hinges on so many coincidences. The king couldn't sleep. They read to him, and they just happened to read about Mordecai's helping the king. And Haman, the villain, just happens to be there. And you see how the tables were magnificently turned on Haman. And he received the foreshadowing of his eventual catastrophic downfall before Mordecai's people, the Jews. Now let's work through the plot in a little bit more detail. First is the problem, chapters 1 through 3. It starts with Queen Vashti being deposed as queen of the Persian Empire, and Esther eventually replaces her as queen. And Esther is Jewish, but she keeps her nationality a secret on the advice of her uncle Mordecai. And Mordecai does a service to the king, protecting him from assassination. And then Haman, one of the king's high officials, despises Mordecai because Haman is proud and insolent. And because Mordecai is Jewish, and Haman was an Amalekite, who's a traditional enemy of the Jews, going all the way back to Samuel, at least. Haman plotted not only to kill Mordecai, but to have all of the Jews exterminated. And he falsely accused the Jews before the king and convinced the king to allow the order for their destruction throughout the entire Persian Empire. And that included the promised land. And then is the providential solution in chapters 4 through 10. First, Mordecai makes a request to Esther for her to use her position as queen to help. After fasting and preparation, Esther goes in to the king at great risk to herself, and she requests that the king and Haman come to a special banquet she's preparing. And of course, Haman, he's filled with pride because he's singled out for this special treatment. Now, in the meantime, Mordecai received his reward from the king, and Haman is humiliated by being the one who's made to honor Mordecai, the guy he's planning to kill. Then Esther finally reveals to the king her request in the presence of Haman. She said, The only thing I request is that my life be spared and my people be spared. And the king is dumbfounded and enraged. Who's trying to kill you? And Esther replies, this vile Haman. And you can just imagine the smug smile being wiped off of Haman's face. And he panics and he begs for mercy from the queen. But this only increases the king's fury. And he has Haman killed in the very manner by which Haman had planned to kill Mordecai. And Mordecai is promoted as the king's advisor. And the order to exterminate the Jews is countered with another order that the Jews should defend themselves from all their enemies. And the Jews triumph, and they celebrate with the Feast of Purim. And that's the end of the story. Not only are the Jews not exterminated, but they are elevated in the Persian Empire, and some are even entrusted with key positions in the king's court. And there was much rejoicing. Now, finally, let's go back to the timeline. Not only the timeline of the book of Esther, but its relationship with the return of the Jews from Babylon to the Promised Land. First, in 538 BC, is King Cyrus's decree and the first wave of return under Zerubbabel, and the temple construction is begun. Then in 520 BC, work on the temple is renewed after being stopped for over a decade. Then finally, in 515 BC, the temple is completed. And then the king of the Esther story, he reigns between 486 and 465 BC. And we don't know for sure, but the Esther story probably happened near the end of his reign. And then in 458, Ezra returns to the Promised Land with a second wave. Remember that Ezra went with the king's blessing and tremendous financial support from the Persian Empire. Then in 445 BC is the third return under Nehemiah and the rebuilding of the wall. And remember that Nehemiah also returned with the blessing of the Persian king, and he was appointed governor over Jerusalem. Now let's think about this for a minute. Why do you think Nehemiah and Ezra were given favor by the Persian government? Well, maybe the favorable answers that Ezra and Nehemiah received in their requests could have been influenced by the continual impact, the ministry, and the queenship of Esther. You see, this book is more than just a love story, but it impacted generations of Bible history through seemingly insignificant coincidences, and the faithful obedience of people in the right place and the right time in the circumstances into which they were put. And that brings us to the theological themes of Esther. First is God's poetic justice. Haman gets exactly what he deserves, and Mordecai gets what Haman wanted. Haman gets exactly what he plotted against Mordecai. See, God makes sure justice happens, and he does it in such a way that there's no mistake that it was deserved, and the punishment fits the crime perfectly. And the next theme is God's behind-the-scenes providence. And this is very similar to what we saw in Ruth. God's sovereign faithfulness is shown in the book of Esther, not in flashy, miraculous ways, but in seemingly insignificant coincidences that don't even need God's name to be mentioned. See, Esther just happens to be chosen as queen out of all the other candidates. Mordecai just happens to save the king. The king just happens to have insomnia on this night. The servant just happens to read from the place in the history about Mordecai's deed. Haman just happens to be there in the courtyard. See, God is not mentioned in Esther, but God is certainly there. And again, take this to heart in your own life. You may not always see God's evident working in all of your situations and circumstances, but he is working because he's God. Be faithful in the circumstances that he has put you in, because you never know that it might be the time and the place and the opportunity. Be faithful and trust him. So now let's review the book of Esther. First, we'll review the organization of Esther, and that is pretty simple: problem and solution. And then we'll review the themes of Esther, and they are poetic justice and providence. Now, because Esther is the last of the historical books, we'll review all of the historical books, and just like we did with the Torah, we'll try to guess their one-word summaries. We're going to try to summarize each book with one word. And I want you to think through what word would be the most appropriate for each of the historical books. And if you need to pause the video for a minute to do that, feel free to do so. But do it quick, because I'm about to start. First is Joshua. And I've gone with the fairly obvious choice of conquest. And I hope that makes sense, because the book of Joshua is about the people possessing the land that God promised Abraham. Next is Judges, and I've chosen the word apostasy, because this book narrates how unfaithful Israel had become during this time. Next is the book of Ruth, and I chose the word faithfulness. Because, as you should recall, one of the major ideas in Ruth is covenant faithfulness. Ruth is faithful to her mother-in-law, Boaz is faithful to Ruth, but especially the Lord is faithful to his people. And then the books of Samuel, and I'm summarizing both books of Samuel together with the word monarchy. And again, I hope this is pretty obvious, because the books of Samuel tell about the start of the monarchy and describe the kind of king that God wants. And next is the books of Kings, and I've chosen the word divided. Now, there's a lot going on in Kings, and many words would have been appropriate. But I chose the word divided to highlight that the unified people of God were divided into two nations, and both went into exile because of idolatry. And next is the books of Chronicles, which I have summarized by the word temple. Again, another tough choice, but I chose temple because of the emphasis in Chronicles is on the temple and the Levitical worship throughout all of the history it covers. And then the two books together of Ezra and Nehemiah, I've summarized with the word return. And I hope that choice is obvious enough. And then finally, I've summarized the book of Esther with the word providence, because of God's behind-the-scenes working to save his people. Now, because we've come to the end of the Old Testament history, let's review quickly the five epochs of history. First, the prehistory, which covers the creation, fall, the downward spiral, and sin. Then the patriarchs. God chose one man, Abraham. He gives the promise to bless the world through Abraham. And the promise is protected, even when it looks doubtful. Then is the Exodus and conquest. God rescues Israel from Egypt. He makes them into a nation. He gives them the covenant and a revelation of his rule. And they capture the promised land. Then is the monarchy. They request a king like other nations, and God gives them a series of kings, some who led them towards Scrub, and others who led them away. The nation is divided, and the northern kingdom is taken over and ceases to exist. And then finally is the exile return. The southern kingdom is taken captive to Babylon, but a small remnant returns to the land, and in its struggles to be the kingdom of God. And that's how the story ends. Now, finally, let's review the Old Testament books so far and their relationship to history. Remember, Genesis through Kings is one continuous narrative, and then Chronicles through Esther retells part of this history. Then we'll see the poetic books and the prophets. They're spread out throughout this history, as we'll see in future sections. But like I mentioned, this is all the history that there is in the Old Testament, what we've covered so far. What about Israel's future? How does the story end? Now, the prophets, they're going to point forward, and we're going to get a glimpse of what God has in store. But we must wait until the New Testament to get the whole picture. Remember, the Old Testament is an unfinished book. The Old Testament history is an unfinished story. But one thing I hope that we can be sure of at this point is how many of God's promises will fail. And that's none. Now, the Old Testament is a record of human failure, but the Old Testament is also a record of God's faithfulness. If the entire human race is a failure because of the sin of Adam and the sin inherited from Adam, what's the hope of humanity? The whole Old Testament shows us that just the same old is not going to work. There's a need for a new start, a new creation, a new Adam, a new heart, and a new spirit. We need a Savior. And as we'll see, that's exactly what is promised in the prophets. And how many of God's promises are going to fail? None. So these promises must come true. Or they've already come true. Or we're now living in the time where they're in process of completely coming true as we speak. So we'll see in the prophets and then in your New Testament survey. But for now, that wraps up the Old Testament historical books and all of the Old Testament history. And in the next section, we'll start to look at the poetic books. Thanks for watching.